morning, everybody. Welcome to Thursday, day four of Spark Week on the Morning Show with Preston Scott. That is Grant Allen over there in Studio 1A. I am here in Studio 1B, day 4562 of the radio program, October the 7th. More on that date in just a moment. Our verse of the day, Isaiah 49:13. Shout for joy, you heavens. Rejoice, you earth. Burst into song, you mountains, for the Lord comforts his people and will have compassion on his afflicted ones. And so that's where we begin today.
We're going to give glory to the Lord here today for what he has done in our lives.
Let's go back.
This is my story.
The Wayback Machine.
All praises to the Lord. Are you ready?
Carmen on the Morning Show with Preston Scott.
I say glory to the Lord. Glory to his name. Here's my story. Giving glory to the Lord today. Glory to the Lord. Glory to his name. Here's my story. Giving glory to the Lord today. Oh yeah.
To testify about what the Lord has done for me. Antes era ciego, used to be blind, but now I see. And demons flee cuando I shout the name of Cristo. Don't need no gangs, no drugs, never get in the show. Don't need that pisto, cause Jesus Christ is the only thing that's running through my brain. The devil had me bound, but he broke them chains. Now to die is gain, and that's my story. Giving all praises to the El Shaddai. He saved my soul, so now I'm gonna praise him until the day is done.
Glory to the Lord. That's right, give glory to his name. Here's my story.
Calvary's tree.
Tell me more.
Me hizo free.
Tell me more.
He healed the sick and gave to the poor. Now must I need say more?
Tell me more.
Se llama Cristo.
Tell me more.
He is the way, the truth, and the light, and the night that shines so bright.
Tell me more.
He's dynamite.
Yeah, that's for sure. I say glory to the Lord. Glory to his name. Here's my story. Giving glory to the Lord today.
I gotta say
glory to the Lord.
Carmen, as we kick off Thursday on Spark Week here on the Morning Show with Preston Scott.
Does this without caffeine? The Morning Show with Preston Scott on News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
Eleven minutes past the hour. October 7th, inside the American Patriots Almanac, here's what we find. 1765, the Stamp Act. Congress meets in New York to discuss colonial grievances against England. That's what it was called, the Stamp Act Congress. We formed a Congress because we were angry at what the Brits were doing. So we fast forward 12 years, 1777, Patriots defeat the British at the Second Battle of Saratoga, New York. In 1780, Patriot militia forces annihilate Loyalist Army forces at Kings Mountain in South Carolina. Thomas Jefferson called it the turn of the tide of success of the Revolutionary War. South Carolina. You don't think about South Carolina so much in the Revolutionary War, but it was a pretty big deal. 1826, the Granite Railway, an early U.S. railroad, begins operation in Quincy, Massachusetts, with horse-drawn wagons hauling stone to build the Bunker Hill Monument. Huh. In 1916, in Atlanta, Georgia Tech beats Cumberland College. The most lopsided game in college football history. The final score? 222-0.
I actually was just talking about this with a friend. A stat from that game is that Georgia Tech, who scored 200-plus points.
222.
They didn't have a single first down. They scored on every play.
That's insane. Yep, there they go again. And that's like, I read a story years ago about a high school football team that was getting beat so badly at halftime, they pulled up the buses. They left.
Ooh.
They left. They just jumped on the buses and said, see ya.
Like they just left the locker room?
They just left the locker room. We have to go out there again, coach.
Please get us out of here.
Please. And then in the year 2001, U.S. troops launch Operation Enduring Freedom. Yeah, that was Afghanistan. Okay, we'll just skip over that. You know what I have in my hands?
A book.
The book. Other than the Bible. I mean, if I were the movie guy, True Raiders tells the untold real-life tale of Monty Parker, a British rogue nobleman who, after being dared to do so by Ava Astor, the so-called most beautiful woman in the world, headed a secret 1909 expedition to find the fabled Ark of the Covenant. This remarkable story reads like Raiders of the Lost Ark, but stands on its own as an incredible chapter in history, one of adventure and mystery, though it has been almost completely forgotten today. Author Brad Ricca brings the story to life in his book, True Raiders. Ooh. Ooh. I get all goosebumply.
I knew you were going to say that.
I get all goosebumply just holding this book. I am so into this story. The story of the Ark. In fact, I've joked. I've desperately tried to get a really good mailing address for George Lucas. Because the Indiana Jones movie they should make is not the one that they're going to come out with, although it's probably a step in the right direction, using an older Indiana Jones. It's Indiana Jones and the Ashes of the Red Heifer. That's what it needs to be called. The way it goes in biblical history and tradition, the story is that Israel is going to rebuild the temple, that somehow it's going to happen on Temple Mount, and they're going to reinstitute sacrifices as in the days of Moses, animal sacrifices, Jewish tradition. But you see, they can't do that unless they have the ashes of the last red heifer. The red heifer was a perfect no blemish, no hair on it that was not red, no white hair on it. It was bred for that purpose, and it's called a perpetual sacrifice. It has to be carried on with the ashes of the previous one. So somewhere are the ashes of the last red heifer, and that's what Indiana Jones ought to be finding.
Jeff LA on your phone with the iHeartRadio app and on hundreds of devices like Alexa, Google Home, Xbox, and Sonos.
And free.
An iHeart radio station.
I'm still holding it in my hands. Truedos. Truedos. It's going to be a great visit with the author, Brad Ricca, next hour on the radio. It's going to be fun. Cannot wait. I'm so geeked up about this interview coming up today. Later in the show, Dr. Steve Severson. A bunch of you allow your dogs and cats to kiss you in the mouth. You guys do that smooching thing kind of sort of the way, you know. You need to think about that, and Dr. Steverson's going to talk about why. You can get really, really sick from your dog's spit and saliva, your cat's spit and saliva getting mixed up with your mouth. And we're going to talk about that for all you pet lovers out there. Look, just trying to help and keep everybody healthy. That's what we do here. Also on the program today, Scott Conant will join us. We'll talk about his new book. He's a celebrity chef. And I interviewed Scott a couple weeks back for this week on the show. I was able to get some time with him. And he's got a new book. It's called Peace, Love, and Pasta. Now, if you watch the Food Network, you know Scott Conant. And if you don't, I can't help you. Other than he's a very cool guy and a really great chef. You see him a ton on Chopped. He's hosting his own version of Chopped now on the Food Network. He's a celebrity judge and does, you know, obviously he's got his own cooking game. But we talked for a few minutes, and I'll share that with you. And we will also talk about the finer art of cooking a steak on the show today. Not with Scott. With Scott, we're just talking about the book and other things. But, like, I mean, could you imagine cooking for someone like that?
Nope.
Like, he's a guest at your house, and you're going to prepare a meal.
No.
And that's what I asked him about that. Who has the courage to do that?
I'd be distraught.
Yeah. Yeah. I would be like, Mom, speak to me, Mom. Tell me what recipe I should pull out, please. Something. I don't think Kipper snacks would work. Kipper's mayo and a little lemon juice. I don't think that would be what I would serve. But that would be a good one. That would be a really fun topic. What would you serve if you had a celebrity chef coming to your home? That would be a fun set of phone calls. But maybe someday. Today, of course, day four of Spark Week. Tomorrow we'll introduce you to Teen Challenge. In the meantime, find out about the cause. It's TallahasseeMensRehab.com and look for the Spark Week Challenge right there on the homepage. And then click that and it'll tell you everything that we're doing and trying to do, trying to help get done. And so check that out. You've heard me talk about Grayson Shepherd. Grayson is a charter boat captain, and you can charter a boat with him and he'll take you out fishing seasonally out in the Gulf. He's really good at what he does, but he also goes down and dives. And I've had him on the show, and we talked about his encounter with a great white off St. George Island.
Whoa.
And at first you're like, wait, what? Yeah. Great whites come into the Gulf. It's a somewhat rare occurrence, but they do, and he encountered one on tape. It's on YouTube. You can find it. He's spearfishing lionfish. Lionfish are an invasive species. They've been turned loose in our waters by some, you know, aquarium owners somewhere, and they just replicate like crazy. So Fish and Wildlife does every year a lionfish challenge where they're saying, go get them.
It's like the kill pythons.
Kill as many as you can. And so the challenge this year ended on September the 6th, on Labor Day, 3.5 month program. Here are your winners. First place in the recreational category is Brooks Feaser of Palm Beach County, who removed 1,632 lionfish.
It's a lot more than I expected you to say.
Second place, Carl Antonick of Santa Rosa County, 1,582 lionfish. Third place, Christina Raber-Jen from Palm Beach County, 1,475 lionfish. In the commercial category, Rachel Bauman of Monroe County pulled 730 pounds of lionfish out. All told, and they get you know, some nominal prizes, like a little bit of money for their scuba tanks for air. They get a really cool trophy and just a couple other little things. 21,146 lionfish were removed.
Oh, my gosh.
Crazy. By the way, they are poisonous to the touch. I mean, those spines will stick you and you won't enjoy it. But if you do spear one or catch them, they are really good eating.
News first. The Morning Show with Preston Scott on News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
Half hour from now, Brad Ricca, author of the book True Raiders, the untold story of the 1909 expedition to find the legendary Ark of the Covenant. I've been fortunate. Before I got back to radio, when I was in vocational ministry, I spent hours on the phone with an author named Grant Jeffrey. And there's some of you that know that name. And Grant told me a fascinating story about what he believed happened to the Ark of the Covenant and where he thinks it is. I'm not going to say anything more about that. It might come up in my conversation with Brad about his book. But at the very least, I'll share that at some point this morning because it was interesting in and of itself. The Ark of the Covenant predates... The interest in the Ark of the Covenant predates Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. That just popularized the whole idea of where is it. And it created a pretty interesting set of ideas, although there are some, you know, some subtle little things inside that movie, like all movies that leave you kind of, come on, you could have done this a little bit better. But still a great movie. It's in my collection. Probably in a lot of your collections as well. I mentioned later on in the program, we're going to talk about cooking a steak. But we're coming to the end of barbecue season for some. And I don't know about you, but I am constantly trying to figure out the best way to clean a grill. And even what kind of grill do I really want? I can't do the charcoal, you know, big green egg, ceramic cookers, smokers. That I can't do that because my wife is real sensitive to smoked meats. And so that kind of thing just, it's not going to be in the cards for me. I, like a lot of you, have had a Weber charcoal grill over the years, you know, the little kettle that you put in the back. And I mean, you cook up great food with those things, no doubt about it. But I have to tell you, cooking, someone someday is going to figure it out. How to make a grill that's easier to clean. But as you get to the end of the season, this is when you ought to be really thinking about cleaning your grill. And if you're going to keep cooking on your grill, that's cool. You should still clean it, do a deep cleaning at least once, maybe twice a year. But there are some subtleties that I didn't really fully embrace until last few years. There are three kinds of grates that are on your grills. There's porcelain, cast iron, and stainless steel, and they all require a different cleaning method. And so that's number one you need to know. that, for example, porcelain is rust resistant as long as you do not scrape them. You avoid scratches, so you don't want to use a metal wire brush on those things. Cast iron, they can handle anything. Unfortunately, they rust pretty easily. So when you clean a cast iron grate, you got to make sure that you oil it down. You season it with some oil. You keep that thing oiled up. And then stainless steel are pretty durable. They don't need a lot of special care. You just make sure you dry those things completely when you're through cleaning them. But one of the best things you can do is when you're through cooking is keep burning for about 15 minutes. If you're using charcoal, spread the charcoal out, put the lid back on it, close the smoker. Don't vent it because you don't want heat venting at all. And if you've got gas, you just let it run for another 15 minutes with the lid closed. You burn off as much of the debris as possible. Soapy water, warm soapy water is your all-time best. I've always found the biggest difficulty is where do you clean it? Where do you clean the grates? You clean them outside in the bucket, that's fine, but then you get a bunch of nasty, greasy grime in your bucket. You go in the kitchen sink, you got another set of problems because it's in your sink. So the soapy warm water does a lot, but vinegar and water mix spray is genius because you don't have to rinse it. Once you clean it, it's clean. The vinegar is not going to hurt you when you're cooking. So just keep your grill clean.
Morning show with Preston Scott.
Yeah, baby. Yeah.
On News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
Food Network celebrity chef Scott Conant. I'll share an interview I had with Scott a few days ago. That's in the third hour of the program. I'm the worst at keeping my grill clean. You have a grill in your backyard?
Yeah, I do.
You keep it clean?
No.
Yeah.
I just have one of those Weber charcoal grills that I just scrape off the stuff.
Yeah.
And then just
let it drop to the bottom in the ashes?
Yep, and then fire it up next go round. That's about it.
Empty the ashes out how often?
A couple times a year. It doesn't...
Not often.
Yeah, not yeah. often.
Yeah, I'm bad about that. In fact, I've got one of those infrared grills that I love. I love the way that this thing cooks because you don't get flare-ups. They're none. Zero flare-ups. But I find you have to replace the plates, the infrared little distribution plates. You've got to get new ones about every year. Because you just can't keep all the gunk off them. And it's brutal. Anyway, if I were more thorough at cleaning, I'd probably get more life out of them. It's really bad. In fact, right now I'm feeling rather ashamed.
I think even if I had the capability or like the space is really for like a gas grill, I think yeah. I'd probably still want to use my charcoal.
I would love to try one of those green eggs.
Yeah, I've never tried one.
They're allegedly amazing.
Cost you an arm and a leg, though, right?
You can get off brands that are the ceramic, you know, cylindrical kind of, you know, oval egg looking things. Yeah. But yeah, they're not cheap. But I'm told those things are really incredible and very efficient in their use of charcoal and so forth.
I mean, they've gained popularity for a reason.
Love to cook a pizza in one of those.
Pizza?
Yeah. I think you can probably cook a pizza pretty good on one of those. I'm guessing. We had Ray Lampe on the show once, Dr. Barbecue. And I met him through a television show that he did. And when I saw him, I just, you know me, I just took a flyer and I reached out. I said, you want to do my show? And he said, sure.
Cool.
Sweet.
Yeah.
He was doing the Florida Fisherman weekly shows and he did a weekly recipe on cooking seafood on the big green egg.
Huh.
And so he's like an expert on using that bad boy. And so anyway, hey, would you use an electric car?
I would, if money wasn't an object and I knew that I was going to work and home, I had a very regimented schedule
yeah.
and I knew I could charge it.
Kind of like what you have.
Yeah, pretty much.
You mean like the life you currently live?
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, like that?
If money wasn't an object, I'd give a Tesla a shot.
You know, there are other electric cars out there. There's more and more coming all the time.
Oh, for sure. But if I'm going to go electric, I'd want to get a Tesla.
Well, years ago, I drove the Nissan Leaf.
Oh, did you?
Yes. And that was pretty enlightening. It was cool. It was cool at the time.
Was it full electric or hybrid?
Full. 100% electric.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was very cool. And every time you braked, you sort of recharged just a little bit. It recharged by way of braking. Anyway, this has been the big thing for me. You know, I would be interested in an electric vehicle for commuting. Like you.
Yeah.
Back and forth in town. No way. I'm not sitting for an hour.
No.
Charging. Well, ABB has come up with what's called the Terra 360 Modular Charger, and it's expected in America next year. It can charge four vehicles at one time.
Whoa!
360 kilowatt capability, and it can charge fully in 15 minutes.
No way!
Or less. 15 or less.
That changes things a little bit.
Well, a little. Get me to 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'll think about it across country, except I always have this fear of being stuck in traffic, like on an interstate. And I'm like looking at my voltmeter and going, what am I going to do now? It's like I want to put a solar charger on the top of it. 46 minutes after the hour.
Morning show with Preston Scott.
My name's Joe Biden. I'm a Democratic candidate for the United States Senate.
I am the Senate.
On News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
Yeah, I've always worried about, you know, because I can't think of the last time I went on a drive of any note and didn't get stopped a few times somewhere in a massive traffic jam.
And if it drags out for longer than you expect, you feel like you're just sitting there antsy watching your voltage go down on your electric car?
Yeah, and yeah. Maybe it doesn't really work that way. Maybe it's minimal usage unless... But I just imagine myself turning off the air conditioner, rolling down the windows, turning off all the electronic, yeah. You know, the radio, everything.
And just sitting there.
Don't move.
Conserve power.
And that's the issue, is with gasoline, there's such a clear, you know, okay, I'm at half a tank or I got a third of a tank left. I'm gonna cap off here. With electric, you're looking at, you know, sitting for a while. And every now and then I can see where, okay, you're going to have lunch. You can charge it up while you're having lunch. That'll work. But, man, when they get that threshold down to 5 minutes.
Yeah, as this becomes more realistic.
Efficient,
yeah. That's when this will get really interesting. And I'd be...
I'm open.
I'm at the very end of the American consumer bell curve. I'm like the last to adopt everything. And so give me about 10 more years of efficient discovery, and then maybe
I'll
give it a shot.
And that's the thing. We're just not there yet. The technology just is not there. There is not the efficiency yet. You know, I think we would all agree it's great to be a good steward of what you've been blessed with across the board. But you still have to find those efficiencies, and fossil fuels just aren't going to go anywhere.
Right.
And
I kind of would want to get just like a big F-250 gas guzzler just to, you know.
Well, I leave my car idling whenever I can.
just to burn, just to make them angry.
Yeah, yeah, just every now and then. I know you are a big Chipotle fan.
I haven't been in a while, but I enjoy it.
Yeah, I've never embraced Chipotle.
Because of their...
Well, no, not because of their politics. I'm not going there this week. I just... When I went to Chipotle with my sweet wife, it was like, I don't know. Maybe I had a bad day, but it seemed to me that everything was cold. I just didn't enjoy it. And as they say, you only get one chance to make a first impression.
Yep.
And the impression on me was just kind of, you know, if I want cold food, I can do that at home any time that I want to make it. I'm very capable of making food. But this guy from Alpharetta, Georgia, did you hear about him?
No.
Wyatt Moss. Wyatt and his buddies decided they had nothing better to do with their life or their money. And so Wyatt made it his mission to spend 50 days eating Chipotle in all 50 states.
Whoa.
Now, I would never have thought Chipotle was in every state.
Idaho doesn't seem like a Chipotle state.
There's Alaska, Hawaii distribution issues.
Yeah.
You know, because you have to get the product to these outlying areas, otherwise it's not Chipotle. And these, you know, these franchise restaurants, they're big on that.
Yeah.
Distribution. You know, that's why Chick-fil-A's been very slow with their footprint expansion. Control. They want control. But he did it. They did over 18,000 miles driving, 9 flights. But they did it. He's now the 15th member of the Chipotle Creator Class. I don't know if that earns him anything, but bragging rights, but he's there. Raiders of the Lost Ark next. Five minutes after the hour, it is hour number two of the morning show with Preston Scott. Thursday, October 7th. Great to be with you. Show number 4,562. But for all practical purposes, it's day four of Spark Week. And as we booked guests for this very special week on the radio program, I put this one down in pen because I was so geeked up about having the conversation with my guest. My guest is author Brad Ricca, and the book is True Raiders. I've been talking about it all week long, the untold story of the 1909 expedition to find the legendary Ark of the Covenant. Brad, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, Preston. Thanks for having me.
Man, do you get this kind of reaction? I mean, are people just generally sort of fired up and giddy to talk to you about this book?
I do get that reaction, and you can tell right away the people like yourself who kind of get it and kind of, you know, remember the movie and kind of hear the soundtrack in their heads. So, yeah, it's been really cool.
You know, for me, it's not just the movie aspect of it. I spent probably 16 years in vocational ministry, studied a ton on the Old Testament, know a little bit about the Ark of the Covenant and many of the theories. But let's start with where this story begins for you. When does this become something that's on your radar?
I think it's sort of similar, but sort of not. So for with me, it's the movie. When I'm a kid, I, you know, went with my dad and my little brother, and that was the movie for me, even more than Star Wars. It was Raiders. And I think it was because of, you know, not just fighting the Nazis and doing all this other cool stuff, but the Ark itself. Because here you have something that as you get older, you learn about and you read about, and it's just such a mysterious and powerful object to, you know, have be in the Bible and yet has disappeared for thousands of years. So that there's all these theories of where it might be or even what it might be. So that's what got me interested a long time ago. And then, you know, kind of flash forward to I'm a writer now and find this topic, and I just couldn't say no to it.
How did you find the topic? When did you become aware of that 1909 expedition before we get into it itself?
Yeah, so I was reading another book. It's this terrific book by Simon Montefiore. It's called Jerusalem. And it's a biography of the whole history of the city of Jerusalem. And he has about a page or so of the expedition. And it's kind of vague and kind of general, but that just made it all the more interesting. And I remember reading it And I felt like my face was melting off, like in the movie, because I couldn't believe that there was an actual, or may have been an actual historical event that led to or inspired Raiders of the Lost Ark, and that this group went after the Ark in 1909. And so I started doing my own research, and then years later, it ended up being a book.
Joining me on the program is author Brad Ricca. You can get the book at all of the traditional outlets, from Amazon to the booksellers that you frequent. It's called True Raiders, The Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. Before we take a quick break, Brad, give me kind of the starting point for this expedition. Where and how does it begin?
Well, it begins in a strange place. There's a Finnish biblical scholar. His name is Dr. Walter Juvelius. He has this great name. And he has said, he claims that he has found a secret code in the book of Ezekiel. And he shows how he goes through it. And with the code, it provides a map to where he says the ark is still hidden underneath Jerusalem. And he brings this to this group of British businessmen and soldiers and ex-soldiers, and they are astounded by what they find, and they begin to raise the money, and they start to get ready for their trip to Jerusalem.
Joining me, Brad Ricca, the book True Raiders. We'll continue our discussion next on The Morning Show with Preston Scott.
Five minutes and he'll give you something to talk about. The Morning Show with Preston Scott on News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
There's going to be about 20,000 Redbox rentals of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Joining me, Brad Ricca of the book True Raiders. When was the last time you saw the movie, Brad?
It's funny you ask, because I saw it right kind of at the beginning of the lockdown. They brought back the Sunday family movie. It was on, I think, ABC, where I grew up with it, where they would always show movies on Sunday nights on regular network television, which, you know, still exists. And they didn't pick Wizard of Oz. They didn't pick something else. They picked Raiders to be the first movie. And I watched it, and it was really great to see on Twitter that everyone was saying, oh, Raiders is my favorite movie, and this and that. So that kind of got me going again when I was in the midst of writing it. But I think I've seen, you know, bits and parts since, but whenever it's on, I watch it.
Absolutely. It's in my collection. Brad Ricca's book is True Raiders. It's about the journey to find the Ark of the Covenant that happened at the beginning of the 20th century. Brad, there are names that are in this ragtag group of explorers, of people that are part of this effort. There are names that we know. There are names that we don't. Who are the key figures in this mission?
So the leader of the expedition is this British nobleman, kind of a scoundrel. His name's Monty Parker. And he's kind of in it in the beginning for the fortune and glory, because they know whoever finds the ark will be rich beyond their dreams. I think that changes as he goes to Jerusalem and looks. He starts to feel the weight of, you know, they're looking for the actual ark, and I think it changes them a little. But there's all these kinds of ex-soldiers that are there kind of just for the adventure of it. There's some psychics they bring along because it's the beginning of the 20th century, and that was part of things. One of my favorite characters is someone they bring on once they're there, who's a priest. He's a French priest living in Jerusalem. His name's Father Vincent, and he's a man of God, of course, but he's also really into archaeology, and he goes into the tunnels and he starts to see things that they don't see. And he's equally kind of just astonished by the spirituality of everything going on around him, but also the science of everything going on around him, that how could people in King David's time have made these tunnels? So there's all different kinds of people working with and against each other.
Another name that stood out to me as a name that I did recognize because of her last name is Ava Astor.
Yeah, so she plays an interesting role. She's married into the Astor family and has a very public divorce. So she comes out of it and moves to London, and she's very wealthy. And she's also, the newspapers call her the most beautiful woman in the world. And she gets linked to Monty, and they start, you know, are seen at parties and horse races and all these kinds of things. And she kind of seems to dump him at one point for someone who has much more money and more prestige. And as she's doing so, he says, you know, well, I may be gone for a while. I might go on this trip to retrieve the Ark of the Covenant. And, you know, well, this is a great line if someone is dumping you. And she pauses and she says, if you bring it back, we'll talk again. So it becomes just another one of those things, you know, that people kind of do that for love, you know, maybe dumb, maybe not. But that becomes part of it, too. And she stays in the story as well, kind of doing her own thing.
Joining me on the program for another segment, Brad, stick around. Brad Ricca is the author of True Raiders. And again, you can get the book at all of the outlets. It's out now. The untold story of the 1909 expedition to find the legendary Ark of the Covenant. A few more minutes with Brad Ricca next on The Morning Show with Preston Scott.
With UFLA on your phone with the iHeartRadio app and on hundreds of devices like Alexa, Google Home, Xbox, and Sonos.
Dude, yes!
And iHeart's radio station.
I could monopolize this guy's time for a full day and not be satisfied. We were just talking in the break. Brad Ricca, author, True Raiders, and it's the story of the effort to find the Ark of the Covenant in 1909. And, Brad, you know, we were talking in the break. Like any detective would take on a case of a missing person by determining the last known location of the missing person. What do we know about the last known location of the Ark of the Covenant?
Yeah, so that's what makes it a little tricky, because there's different, you kind of have to read like much of the Bible, especially the Old Testament, read between the lines, kind of look in the spaces. So it disappears. And it seems to be that it would have been carted away by Nebuchadnezzar, by the Babylonians. But there's lists in the Bible of what they took when they sacked the temple, and the Ark is not on those lists. And that's what makes it very enticing. And when I was researching the Parker expedition, their argument, which I think is very persuasive, is that the Ark wasn't taken because at the last minute it was secreted away. And it is still under the mountains, under the hill of Jerusalem. And one of the arguments is that because the Ark had to be so carefully maintained and couldn't be looked upon by anyone but the high priest, that the Ark was always in a secret place underneath the mountain. Some depictions of it in the temple for everyone to see just don't like fit with the rules. So they thought it was still there.
Where does your research start? I mean, where do you begin to even find the records of this particular event?
Yeah, so I was lucky that many of the people who went on the trip wrote about it and kept a journal or wrote things about it. So I had to get many things translated from Finnish and Swedish. And so they gave me their versions. But also the actual records of the expedition did survive, and for decades it was thought that they didn't exist. But we were able to find them And they have everything from maps to expense reports to reports. And the amazing thing about it is how serious and professional this was. Even though they weren't archaeologists, they weren't just going for a weekend to have a good time and, oh, we'll look for the Ark, in between drinking games. They really went after this thing. So it paints this picture of a large-scale effort to recover the Ark in one of those hidden tunnels that has been there since before the Old Testament.
I told you in the break I was not going to do any kind of spoiler here, so I will ask my final question this way, Brad. Do you expect that one day before you pass this earth, there will be an epilogue to this book?
That is a terrific question. So I will say that, you know, the end is kind of mysterious. They find a place that I think is very persuasive as to where it could be. But what happens is a little mysterious because, A, it's the Ark, but because they don't really talk about it afterwards. But as for that epilogue, you know, since writing this book, I've gotten emails and messages of people who have said, oh, I've got your book, and by the way, I'm going, you know, in 3 months with this equipment, and I've used satellites, of people who are still looking and actively looking. And, you know, I don't know who's right or who's wrong, but we're still looking for the Ark. This so many, I mean, I have my own ideas where or what it might be, but yeah, I would love to write that epilogue someday.
Brad, it's been a joy having you on the program this morning. I wish you nothing but the best for your book, and thanks so much for making time for me.
Oh, thank you. This was really, really terrific.
Thanks so much. Have a great day. Brad Ricca with us this morning. And again, the book is True Raiders, The Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. The story I was told by an author named Grant Jeffrey, who is a biblical scholar, who has deep connections with Israeli intelligence and military, is that the Ark was recovered years ago by the Israeli military, and specifically that members, descendants, if you will, of the tribe of Levi that were in the military were used specifically to bring the Ark out of where it was. And I won't go into that, too much of a story there. But that the Ark of the Covenant is now in the possession of the Israeli government awaiting the rebuilding of the temple. But there's one significant issue. There's another building on Temple Mount, and it's called the Dome of the Rock, where Muslims worship. 27 minutes after the hour. True Raiders, Brad Ricca, my guest on the morning show with Preston Scott.
Sensei of Sensibility. The morning show with Preston Scott on News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
What I'll say about the potential of the Ark of the Covenant being under Temple Mount. Drawing on my limited but still better than average knowledge of history of Jerusalem, of Israel itself, it would explain why Israel has repeatedly, routinely won. When you look at biblical history and you look at biblical prophecy about the scattering of the Jews to all four corners of the world and the regathering to their homeland, which happened on May 15th, I believe it was, 1948. And what's significant about that is that if the stories are correct and if the Ark of the Covenant and what it represents and who, more importantly, it represents, and its location is accurate, it would give some explanation to how, without any organized military, the day that Israel declared itself a nation again, they were attacked by every border nation with an organized military. Yet Israel won. How? And if you go back through history, every time a significant event was about to take place to jackhammer the some of the remaining gates on Temple Mount from the old temple being on that area. I mean, that's why, you know, the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, that wall is like that's biblical time stuff there. That's why it's where people go. The presence of the Ark inside there somewhere might be a plausible explanation, naturally, for the supernatural victories that Israel has won throughout its history. I mean, there are literally accounts of planes getting ready to bomb and blow open some of these gates on the temple that are considered sacred, but nonetheless rubble, and how those efforts failed inexplicably. It's just, it's crazy stuff. Unless you believe. At the very least, it's fascinating. You can read the book? You can read it?
I may take a look at it. Okay. I'll just add it to this, like you mentioned earlier this week. I've got a stack of books that I got to work through too. So
this one's finding its way.
Could work its way to the top.
One's making its way up a little bit higher. Oh man. Yeah. Wow. I'm posting the interview. I'm going to put that interview up today. Like the moment the show's over, it's going up. It's worth it. I do have a blog going up, by the way, tonight about stuff that it's just too big. I can't push it back. So good stuff hitting the blog page today and tonight. WFLAFM.com/Preston. Don't forget, we are trying to help Teen Challenge. If you can help out, go to TallahasseeMensRehab.com. Look for the Spark Week Challenge.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings in a single bound.
It's the Morning Show with Preston Scott on WFLA.
Again, just a reminder, if you can help, we're trying to kickstart a project that they really need some help with. And it's a men's rehab center that serves the entire region. Most of their clients come from outside the Tallahassee area. So if you can help out, TallahasseeMensRehab.com, and look for the Spark Week Challenge. It's Spark Week. We're here to help. We're here to encourage. We're here to inform. And in this case, we're here to help you keep from making a really gross mistake. And joining us is Dr. Steve Steverson. It's our Pause for Thought segment. He's with the Bradfordville Animal Hospital. Hello, sir.
Hey, Preston. How are you?
Good. I sent you the article from IFL Science, and I'm just going to read the headline, and I've asked you to offer your considerable expertise to weigh in on the subject, and here's the headline. Kissing your dog isn't just gross. It can potentially make you very sick.
That's very, very true, Preston. You know, a dog's mouth has hundreds of different types of bacteria in it, just like a person's does. But the deal is that a dog's mouth has a different types of bacteria than a human does. A lot of bacteria that we're not used to, our bodies aren't adapted to. And so when a dog licks you or you kiss your dog, that bacteria can get in your mouth or in a cut or a sore on you. And those bacteria that we're not used to, aren't prepared to control, can cause some very, very serious problems in a human.
It's interesting because as I've observed dogs, like if you get a scrape or you get a cut or a scratch or an abrasion, and it's a wound, dogs will lick those things.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's their natural instinct.
Right.
To clean a wound. If it's their own wound, their body's used to that bacteria in their mouth, and so mechanically cleaning that wound is not a bad thing necessarily. But like I said, if it's a dog or a cat and they're trying to lick our wounds, that's not a good thing. So, you know, all those different types of bacteria, there's, you know, some Pasteurella and some Neisseria, a lot of different types of bacteria that could be really pathogenic in our body that we don't want them to put on our skin.
So pet number one on the totem pole, I'll always put dogs. Don't let your dogs lick you on the mouth.
Pretty much any of your pets, Preston, a dog, dog or a cat.
And I wanted to ask you, what about cats?
Yep, same thing. Cats, just like a dog, a cat's mouth is different than a dog's mouth. It's different than ours. Same principle. They have different bacteria that their body's adapted to. We're not adapted to those bacteria necessarily, so it's not a good idea.
You know, you said something to me in a note that I never thought about, and that is what couples that are expecting a child ought to be thinking about.
Yes. So there is an organism that the cats can carry called toxoplasma, and toxo is an organism that people get. Very common. If you have had a cat, grown up with cats, you probably already had toxo at some point. It doesn't show any symptoms when you get it. You get this organism in your body, your immune system rejects it, and now you're immune for life to toxo. But if you are pregnant, and during your pregnancy you were exposed to toxo, during that phase when you're going through that immune response, it can cause damage to the baby. And so that's why you always hear, you know, when you have a pregnant couple that's pregnant and the husband always is the one that deals with the litter box and deals with the cat, that's wise, because you worry about toxo in a pregnant female.
That is really important information, and that's why I wanted to address this, because when I read this article, I was like, oh, wow, that's crazy. And I know it's somewhat rare, but it's still just an issue of cleanliness. I mean, as you point out, we know where dogs and cats' tongues have been. You know what I mean? We know where they've been.
Yeah. Well, you know that the chances of having a problem from a dog licking you is more likely to be struck by lightning, the odds are, than to have a problem. But when it happens, it can be very, very serious. And just on a general note, if you think about it, you know, where does a dog put his nose in his mouth all the time? You know, inappropriate places.
It's so, butt. That's where. I'll say what you didn't want to say. Dr. Stevenson, thanks so much for the time.
Great. Thanks, Preston.
All right, Dr. Steve Stevenson of the Bradfordville Animal Hospital, my guest. Pause for thought on The Morning Show with Preston Scott.
Known as Mr. Know-It-All. The Morning Show with Preston Scott. News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
Tomorrow on the program, we'll introduce you to Teen Challenge. Executive Director Austin McElroy will join me, along with Program Director Kyle Sechrist. And I think you'll enjoy getting to know about the program. I'm also going to introduce you to one local businessman that stepped up to help. And we'll go into what he does, what his business is, and why he wanted to help. And so tomorrow we hope to end Spark Week with a bang, with a little fire, helping out a very good and noble cause. My interview with Brad Ricca is going to post at 9:15 this morning. If you want to check that out again, share it with others. I hope you'll enjoy it. I know you will. back up. I know you will. I don't hope any. I know you'll enjoy it because it was really a good visit. And that'll be hitting the blog page at WFLAFM.com. Want to follow up again for just a second on pets. There is now more evidence into why dogs in particular and some cats act really weird when storms are approaching. I don't know if you've ever noticed. I remember my dog Scooby did not like thunderstorms, did not like lightning, did not like heavy rainfall storm at all. And it's always been interesting to me why the fear. And, you know, we've talked with Dr. Steverson over the years about those what are they called? They're thunder vests, where they're actually like a vest that you clip onto your dog or cat, and it kind of hugs them, and they tolerate storms better.
It'll, like, give them a sense of security. Because there's something close, you know, something like that.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Nicholas Dodman at the Center for Canine Behavioral Studies at Tufts University said about 50% of all dogs with thunderstorm phobia seek out a bathroom appliance like a bathtub, etc. Not all of them, but about 50% that have a problem to press against them. They lean and push against those things. And as I read through this article, I was fascinated to learn. He said, my first sort of revelation was three dogs in a row that came to see me in clinic. At least their owner brought them to see me. It's not like the dogs made an appointment, laid down on the couch, and said, let me tell you my problems. They were all German Shepherds, which is an anxiety-prone breed. All three of them, one after another, the owner said, my dog jumps in the sink during a storm. Dodman calls the static electricity theory of dog phobia. He said, the idea is dogs can feel the buildup of static electricity in a storm, so they naturally try to escape the static charge by moving toward items that are grounded. He said, think of wearing a thick woolly sweater in the winter. The wool, or in your dog's case, their fur, is a good insulator of static electricity. And you discharge the static by touching something that's grounded or a good conductor. That's when you feel the shock. He said, they can surely sense it, and there are lots of other indications throughout the world of static, like longhorn cattle in Texas. He said, cowboys know when there's going to be a storm because they have a little flicker of blue light coming from the tips of the horns of the cattle.
That's wild.
Yes. He said, static discharges through sharp points.
That makes sense.
With dogs, their paws and coat can insulate them, preventing static electricity from escaping, which can then accumulate in their bodies. Are they actually terrified of being stratified static electricity? He said, I don't think that's the answer. I think the answer is when they are charged and they touch something, dogs explore with their noses. They get a sharp shock delivered through their nose, and it's painful. So he said, the best way to help your pet break through is rub them down with an anti-static laundry sheet. One of those dryer sheets when a storm's approaching. How about that? Time for news. Effort to just give you a break. The week has gained a little momentum as we've gone. I have to tell you, the first couple days, it was a little challenging for me. But I found my footing yesterday. In fact, I came home Tuesday and I told my wife, I said, I stink. I was just struggling. Transitioning. Getting myself fully disengaged from everything and easing into just alternative content for a week. But we've done it, and every day gets a little bit better, just in time for it to end. And then we go back on Monday to normal programming here on the morning show. But remember, we are trying to help folks at Teen Challenge. It helps men beat addictions to drugs, alcohol, and prescription meds, and they take in patients from the region. Very few patients are from Tallahassee, and I say that because I don't want those of you in the outlying areas to think, ah, it's a local cause. No, it's a regional cause, and they really could use your help. So just find out more. That's all I'm asking you to do. Find out more, pray about it, talk about it as family, see what you can do to help. And just go to the website, TallahasseeMensRehab.com. Simple as that. All right. A couple weeks ago, I had a chance to visit with Food Network chef Scott Conant. Chopped is one of his big shows that he's on. Chopped Sweets, he hosts. And he's got a brand new book, Peace, Love, and Pasta. And we started the conversation. I said, okay, this is kind of a no-brainer for a chef. I mean, peace and love. But really, I mean, what is a chef doing talking about pasta?
Well, I think it's really a reference to my own evolution over the past 35 years of cooking, where I was one of those guys who was in kitchens 100 hours a week for years. And then I had kids, and I think that idea of cooking from my heart, spending more time at home, nurturing my daughters, started to be a lot more interesting to me. So these are recipes that I cook for them, and things that I cook at home, and because I love entertaining, but I also just I love feeding my family.
How did you arrive at what actually made the cut? I mean, you just said it. You've been doing this a long time. A lot of recipes have come across your hands and your eyes. So what made the cut?
You know, my writer and I would talk about this for hours, trying to figure out exactly what it is. And I think ultimately I just went with the things that I love and things that I cook. We left a lot on the edit room floor, so to speak, but, you know, hopefully those will be for the next book.
Of course, there's gotta be another book that follows it up, right? When you talk about recipes, what level of cook does someone need to be to embrace a Scott Conant recipe? I mean, come on, you've got some serious skills.
Thank you. Well, you know, that's the thing. I wanted to make some recipes, utilize recipes that are really simple to put together with little small tweaks that just kind of differentiate them from say, other recipes that are out there, kind of personalized touches.
Does anyone ever have the nerve to cook for you? That's not like not in the sphere of the cooks and chefs that you spend time around professionally, but I mean, can just a guy cook a meal in front of you and not just sweat through his apron?
Well, I love when people cook for me. I mean, what kind of house guest would I be if I wasn't appreciative of people cooking for me, right? Yeah, I think that's, you know, I don't get a lot of, my wife always laughs, we don't get a lot of invitations to people's houses for dinner, but I always appreciate when I do.
Yeah, he appreciates what he does. I wouldn't do it. There's no way. If I knew Scott Conant personally and he were coming to my house, I'd say, what do you want me to buy? You're cooking. It's just that simple. More with Food Network chef Scott Conant next.
The Morning Show with Preston Scott.
And I live in a van down by the river.
On News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
There is an entire set of industries that really owe cable television a lot. because cable TV is so niche oriented. You think about HGTV DIY, but most notably for the topic at hand, the Food Network. And just think about how the Food Network has allowed people like Scott Conant to have a platform. And so when I got a chance to talk with him, because I'm a big fan of the Food Network, I enjoy it. Scott Conant of Chopped and the new book, Peace, Love, and Pasta. What's the single biggest mistake you think the average cook at home makes? If they pick up your book and they start cooking, what's the biggest mistake we might make that keeps us from maybe getting the best out of that meal?
Well, I hate to say it, but you know, we all have a little bit of an attention deficit disorder. So just reading the recipe first before trying to execute it is an important first step, I would say.
What about the ingredients? Because I can only imagine that you've got maybe a pantry that looks a little different than mine.
I do admittedly have an extensive pantry, but most of the ingredients in this book are things that you can find in your average grocery store, with few exceptions. I mean, there's a thing called neonata that I do with fusilli and chicken livers, which is like Calabrian chilies and little tiny fish. But you could easily find that on the internet and have it shipped to your house.
Scott Conant is with me. You know him from the Food Network and Chopped Sweets, and a new book, Peace, Love, and Pasta, and simple and elegant recipes from a chef's home kitchen. My guest for just a couple more minutes here on the morning show. Scott, if there was one recipe you would say, this is the one I hope everybody tries because they'll be hooked on the book the rest of the way, what's that one recipe?
You know, I have to say that there's several. But I'll give you one. I kind of did a chicken parmesan in a little bit of a different way, where okay. I made chicken cutlets. I love chicken cutlets, and then there's melted baby tomatoes with it, served a little bit off to the side, so you maintain the texture of the chicken cutlet, and then a nice, beautiful piece of burrata on top of that. It really is a sexy dish.
Scott, last question for you. If I'd have told you when you got into this business years ago and started to have some success that there would be such a thing as the Food Network and it would become what it has become, would you have just thought I was insane?
No, I would have asked where to sign up, I think.
So you're not surprised by what's happened with as a result of the Food Network, because it's changed food cooking in homes forever.
Oh, it's changed. It's changed the conversation. It's changed the way people speak about food. Also, you know, everybody is a judge these days, or so it feels. Yeah, but I am surprised by it because I don't think anyone saw the success of the Food Network being what it is. I mean, it is. It's part of our culture.
Well, I have really enjoyed, I know you've got a lot of other interviews to do today, and I've really enjoyed just getting a few minutes with you, Scott. I am a huge fan of what you do on the programs where you're on, and I love the network in general. So thanks for time, and I wish you the best on your book.
I really appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Scott Conant with us this morning from the Food Network. And again, the book, Peace, Love, and Pasta, simple and elegant recipes from a chef's home kitchen. And no, Scott Conant is cool. I've had Chef Mark Murphy on the program, now Scott Conant. There's a few others I'd love to get on the program, but I'm really happy that we've had Scott on the show today on The Morning Show.
Take UFLA on your phone with the iHeartRadio app and on hundreds of devices like Alexa, Google Home, Xbox, and Sonos.
Hey, so here we go.
An iHeart radio station.
Okay, today's show has taken a decided turn towards food. Hour number one, we were talking about cleaning your grill. And first, I'd be fascinated to hear what you think is the best grill out there. Gas, charcoal, wood-fired, with a smoker, without a smoker, the ceramic, you know, big green egg style. I'd be curious to know what you think is the best grill and why. Because I'm going to be replacing my grill. I think I can get one more year out of it. Some holes rusted into the back of it. And it was not a cheap grill. It was not an inexpensive grill. But even with a cover on it and all, it just, you know, you get what you get out of it. And so I'm going to be replacing my grill. Now, I doubt I can go charcoal for reasons I explained in hour one. But I am going to be looking. So if you have suggestions for me, ease of cleanup, that kind of thing, and it's got to be big. When I cook, I don't grill a ton, but when I do, there's some food going on that thing. There's a bunch of wings going on there. There's a bunch of burgers or chicken breasts or whatever. Like, I got friends coming over in about 10 days, and I'll be cooking up like 24 chicken breasts, and I'm going to be grilling like crazy. So we need to think ahead about those types of events as I go forward. But one thing I've learned is the challenge of cooking a steak perfectly. Have you ever grilled a steak, or do you put it in a skillet?
Oh no, I've grilled it on my charcoal grill.
Have you been satisfied with the result?
I actually have. I've been, you know, pretty content with what I've been able to do.
Because I'm going to tell you that I have come to the conclusion that the finest way to cook a steak is on a cast iron skillet. Now, I am open to the idea of placing a cast iron grill attachment onto my grill so that it cooks in its juices and so forth, and you sort of have a skillet on your grill. But you got to get that thing fired up and hot. But I came across 7 mistakes that you make when cooking a steak.
Okay.
Number one, you bought lean steak. That's a big time no-no. You're looking for marbling in your meat. You've got, you know, lean cuts are generally a little tougher. But when you're looking for a steak, you've got to get a tender cut. You've got to get the filet. You've got to get the New York strip, the T-bone, or ribeye. You've got to find marbling. You have to. It's got to have that fat content in there. Number two, you didn't season your steak in advance. And you can just go with a little salt and pepper. It doesn't have to be heavily seasoned. Both sides, about 30 to 40 minutes before cooking, gives it a chance to get absorbed in, gets a little juicier, a little more flavorful. But waiting to do the salt and pepper is a disservice to your steak. You didn't blot the raw steak. The wetter the surface of your steak, the more likely it is to steam when it hits the hot pan. You don't want that. So you blot it. You make sure you get moisture off of it before going to a pan. You get rid of residual moisture. That way you get a crisp, caramelized crust on that steak. And then that leads to the next one. You did not let your pan get hot enough. You've got to get that pan smoking hot. You've got to let the pan or the grill, if you're just going to grill, you've got to get it get really hot. Because if you want that crust right, that sear properly, you're going to get steam instead of sear. And then the problem is going to be you're going to be losing moisture. That sear keeps the juices in the steak, and that's important. Not using a meat thermometer. A meat thermometer is invaluable, but get a good one. Don't go cheap. Get a good one. I'm a big fan of Instant, but accurate. But give me accurate over Instant any day of the week. There are little, like, sort of ways that some people determine the wellness of a steak of meat cooked, and they'll use the space between the thumb and the forefinger. And when it reaches a certain point, when you have your fingers held kind of apart, there's that little webbing gap in your hand. That's the kind of toughness or the kind of spring that you want in a medium steak. Now, that's what I've been told. And so you base it on that. A little more give, you're a little more rare. A little less give, you're a little more well done. And last but not least, the mother of all mistakes, you cut it too soon. When you pull a steak off the grill, let it sit and let the juices assimilate back into the meat. It will stay hot and it will be perfect. Don't cut it right away. Give it 7, 8, 10 minutes before you cut that steak. There you go. Come back. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that cast iron issue.
When you thought you were right. The Morning Show with Preston Scott on News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
Almost 36 minutes past the hour here this morning. You paying attention to what's going on Jeopardy?
No.
I'll get to that in just a couple minutes. Now, obviously, there is more than one way to cook a steak. And I'm not a big steak eater. But if I'm going to have a steak, I want a good one. A good steak at the right time is spectacular. I will say that. It just, and you get the right sides, and there's something magical about it, I will tell you. But what follows here are just a few little thoughts on cooking a steak with a cast iron skillet. Couple little things to think about. Number one, I'm going to take the cast iron skillet, I'm going to take it out to the grill. I'm not going to do it inside because I don't want to deal with all of the splash of the grease. I don't want any of that stuff inside. I hate cleaning grease from the inside kitchen. Cannot stand the splashing up on the oven, on the range rather. And so I'm going to take this bad boy outside. I'm going to start my grill. I'm going to get my steaks prepped like we talked about. And you're going to heat your skillet as you heat your grill. You put it on the side of the grill, one side or the other. Turn those burners on. You should at least have a couple burners on your grill. Have them both just as hot as you can make them. And close the lid. We're not putting a steak on it yet. We're just putting that pan in there on one side of the grill with the lid closed. Put a little olive oil on the steak. Okay, rub just a little bit of olive oil on the steak. And then put them on the grill. Not the pan yet. The grill. Don't close the grill. Leave it open. Because you're only going to let that steak on there for 1 to 2 minutes. Because as hot as that thing is, that's all it's going to take to put some grill marks on there. Because grill marks just look good to the eye. And you're starting that searing process. So once you get grill marks on both sides after 1 or 2 minutes, then you're going to put it in the cast iron skillet on the grill and close the lid. Now, at that point, you want to be paying attention to the temperature of the grill. Now, that's a challenging thing because most grill thermometers are just brutal. They're just not real accurate. So you're going to have to kind of, you know, get a feel for your grill by putting one of those temperature things in there to kind of let you know what the real temperature is, not trusting the thermometer on the lid. And you want to keep the temperature at about 400 degrees. If it's too hot, you need to open the lid up and bleed a little temperature out. But an instant read thermometer, a meat thermometer, is an absolute must. And you cook it to your taste, whatever that might be, whether it's medium rare, rare, medium, medium well, whatever that might be. I personally think cooking a steak to well done is a sin. I think it's sinful to cook all the juice out of it. The reason why cast iron works better is, see, a grill is only going to cook where that grate touches the meat. With cast iron skillet, not only are you getting more even cooking throughout the meat, you're avoiding flare-ups because the juice stays in. It stays in the pan. It doesn't bounce over and cause flare-ups that could cause you a giant disaster, depending on your grill. So there you have it. The do's and don'ts of cooking a great steak. Because to me, the cooler weather, I love grilling in cooler weather. Absolutely love it. A lot of people shut down their grills in the fall and winter. That's when I enjoy cooking more than anything else. But I could be a little weird. All right, when we come back, I'm going to give Grant the heads up on what's going on Jeopardy. Some of you know. That's next.
Someone has to say it. The Morning Show with Preston Scott on News Radio 100.7 WFLA.
Kevin just wrote, I'm on a diet. You're not helping at all. Getting a lot of email in the box. Yes to a cast iron skillet. Yeah, yeah. And a great seasoned cast iron skillet is just, I don't know, there's just something almost historical about it. When you think of all the great meals cooked in that cast iron skillet. My wife has her grandmother's cast iron skillet. And it's fun to cook in. It's not a very big one. It's not one that you cook a bunch of steaks in, I guarantee you that. But when you do cook something in it, there's just something so cool and nostalgic about it. You think of all the great meals that were prepared in that skillet over the years. And I can taste every one of them. Okay, I'm just kidding. All right, let me tell you about Matt Amodio. The other night on Jeopardy, Matt is $41,800 higher than second place heading into Final Jeopardy. Just get your mind around that number.
It was a blowout.
He has $41,800 more than second place.
Okay.
$41,000 on Jeopardy is a huge final payout.
For sure.
He risks $37,000 of it. Now, clearly he knew that if he was wrong, he was going to end up still the champion because his lead was so formidable. But he wasn't. He was correct, as he had been for 34 previous shows. He is now second on the all-time list. In the printing of this article, he's at 35 wins and counting. That's 7 weeks of Jeopardy.
Why have I not heard of this?
It's becoming a thing because even Ken Jennings now is saying, whoa. That's literally a one-word tweet that he pushed out. Whoa, when he heard about the bet. So he's now second. Obviously, the all-time money leader is not on the all-time list because the all-time money leader is not necessarily Ken Jennings because the money was a little less back then. But Jennings is still the man to beat because he had 74 consecutive wins.
Jeez.
74. So where does this young man, Matt Amodio, end up? We don't know. He's at 35 officially is the number I've got in front of me, so he might be close to halfway there.
Good luck.
I can't conceive of being that smart and that quick.
Yeah.
It's not just knowing something.
It's blowing everyone else out.
It's the recall. It's being able to pull it out in that second you're hitting your button. That's crazy smart. That's next level brightness to me. So I don't sit and watch Jeopardy very often. But when I do, I like having a good iron skillet cooked steak. No, I'm just kidding. 46 minutes after the hour. We are leading into Glenn Beck playing Buck tomorrow on the program. Life hacks. If you have shortcuts for getting things done, routine chores, tasks, things you've read about, heard about, seen, or have tried, particularly of interest to me, things you personally can vouch for, I would love to hear from you tomorrow. We're going to do that in place of What's the Beef. We're going to do a phone segment of life hacks in the third hour. I think that'll be fun. Lead researcher came up with that yesterday. We had a brief staff meeting, and I said, hey, I need a replacement phone segment. I don't want to do What's the Beef. I don't want to do What's the Blessing because we're doing that Thanksgiving. So lead researcher said, what about life hacks? I looked around the room, looked everybody, all the entire staff, right in the eye. Meeting adjourned. Done. Done. So that's what it'll be tomorrow in the program. Also tomorrow, Austin McElroy, Executive Director, Kyle Sechrist, Program Manager with Teen Challenge. They will both be joining me in studio. We'll talk about Teen Challenge. Remember, TallahasseeMensRehab.com if you can help. Look for the Spark Week Challenge right there on top. If you have a business, if you personally have just done well over the last year and you've got some resources, you get a tax credit. But more importantly, you get to help people. And that's what this week is really about, is pushing away from the noise, circling back and looking at other people and saying, what can we do to help? And this was the cause that that I chose. And so I hope that you'll join my wife and me in supporting Teen Challenge with a gift towards this renovation that they need to do for the safety and welfare of the residents. Also tomorrow, we'll talk with a local businessman who stepped up and took the challenge. That's going to be cool in and of itself. So, yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to tomorrow.
Brought to you by Barino Heating and Air. It's the Morning Show 180 on WFLA.
Talked about food a lot today, grilling, the right kind of grill. Got a note here from Jason. He said, Blackstone griddles. Go away from the grill. Go with a griddle. It's funny that he did that because I've actually been thinking of going that route, going with an outdoor flat top because you can cook so many more things than you can on a grill that has all of those, you know, grates that things fall through. Now you can get attachments, but I love the idea of an outdoor flat top. Cleaning so much easier. So that's something I'm looking at. And so Jason swears by the Blackstone products. I've been looking at them. And so thanks for that. Terry wrote in about the perfect steak. He said Pittsburgh rare. Said there's that's something, it's a term that's used in part of the state. And that's where it is charred on the outside, but still rare or almost raw on the inside. Yeah, I'm not into raw. I'm not into tying into my base ancestral instincts. No, thank you. But anyway, we had a great visit talking food with Scott Conan of the Food Network. I also had just an amazing visit with author Brad Ricca. The book True Raiders. That interview will be posting in 20 minutes on the blog page. Got a big blog posting tonight. It's sort of back on task, but it had to be out there. So check out the blog page and avail yourself of all the content. Come back often because there'll be things posting, as I said, tonight. Tomorrow it'll be the Friday final edition of Spark Week. although we'll continue the cause for Teen Challenge for probably another week thereafter. Just a little jogging of the memory. We'll see how it's all unfolding. We'll keep you updated on that. But in the meantime, thank you so very much for joining us and sharing time with us. Have a great day.